Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello, and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates, episode by episode, the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is frequent commenter on the Fire & Water Podcast Network and our pal, Captain Entropy. How you doing, Captain?
Outstanding, General Kelly. It's a pleasure and an honor to meet you.
It is great to finally have you on one of our shows. You have been a commenter on our boards for many, many years, and your comments are always very insightful, very informative, very interesting. I'm always happy to see your name pop up on one of my show's comment threads. And so I'm just really honored that you're here to actually talk with me and doing one of my shows, namely MASHcast. And I said your handle, your online handle, which we will be using throughout this show, is Captain Entropy, which is a great name. And so I, you know, of course, I have to give everybody a rank by being on the show. So I decided to name you Captain Entropy. So maybe if you come back, you know, for a later episode, you could be Major Captain Entropy or something like that. But for the purposes of this episode, I'll just simply call you Captain.
That sounds perfect. I'm used to it.
All right. So the episode we're here to talk about is, of course, season 4, episode 23, the penultimate episode of season 4, Deluge. It originally aired on February 17th, 1976. It was written by Larry Gelbart and Simon Muntner and directed by William Jurgensen. Now, before we get to the plot of this particular episode, such as it is, Captain, you're new to the show, at least as a guest, as I said. So why don't you explain, how did you become a fan of MASH the series?
Well, I didn't really have any choice. I was born into a family of MASH fans. So, and it was a military family. And it always strikes me funny that there are some people who think that MASH takes an anti-military stance. Because my father, who is the career military guy in our household, although my brother and I both went on to serve in uniform, he always took it as good-natured ribbing and you know, sometimes making fun of things that needed to be made fun of. And so after he retired, he had 20 years in when I was 6 years old. So most of the time it was something that was in the past, but it was kind of the military aspect of our family was always there. And when he would come home from his post-retirement civilian job, MASH would be on in the late afternoons, right before the evening news. And we would watch it then. And later on, when my mom was working nights, sometimes it would be on at 10:30 at night in syndication, and we would watch it together then. And then, of course, you know, it was on live every week. So, or not live, but it was,
yeah,
it was
brand new episodes. Yeah.
Right. MASH was always around.
So, yeah, I mean, I've said this across this season because, of course, he's new to the show, but you know, the rap that MASH gets, that it was, you know, anti-military, or, you know, considered everyone who was in the military to be, you know, worthy of derision or a warmonger or whatever, you know, whatever phrase you want to use. I feel like any episode of the show going from season 4 on really undercuts that canard simply because of the presence of Colonel Potter. You know, any show that features a character like Colonel Potter is clearly not portraying everyone that's ever in the military as a dummy, because Colonel Potter is like the ideal commander in every respect. He's a father figure. So obviously, and you know, as we know, Colonel Potter is a creation of the show. He's not a character borrowed from the movie. So clearly the people that made MASH, yes, as you said, they could kid the army, kid the people in the army, but they also had respect for people in the services, because again, look at Colonel Potter. He's the you know, he's one of the most heroic characters ever to be on television.
And he's shown to be a great commander in this episode too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So now I assume you watched the show, like after it went off the air, did you continue to follow it in reruns, and it's like, did it sort of like deepen on you, or were you away from it for a while and then you got back to it?
The latter. So, I had watched MASH so much that I hit a point where I wasn't really sick of it, but I didn't feel like I had to watch it anymore because I thought I had every episode memorized, you know. And then after a number of years, I started seeing it come up in syndication again, especially on, you know, some of the basic cable channels. And I started picking it up again and episodes here and there, and realizing that after that separation, I didn't remember everything as well as I thought I did. MASHcast started, and that started an entirely new rewatch.
Well, I'm glad to have helped contributed in that regard. So it's very cool. So like I said, the episode we're here to talk about is the penultimate episode of season 4, Deluge. And, you know, as I mentioned in last week's show, or I talked with Amanda Reyes talking about the More I See You, I really do believe, and we'll talk about this later on too, but these final three episodes of season 4, The More I See You, Deluge, and The Interview, to me, is the bedrock of this show's brilliance. Because to me, these three shows are all A-plus episodes, and they are entirely different from one another. In some ways, I mean, you could argue that the style of Deluge is kind of leading the audience, almost prepping it for what they're going to get in The Interview in terms of the sort of documentary form. But nevertheless, it's three different themes, you know, talking about there's, you know, The More I See You is a character piece. And then this is Deluge is, you know, the one of the worst possible days at the 477. And then The Interview is like a, you know, again, like a really form busting thing. But I look at these three shows as almost, and they're not, you know, they weren't constructed this way, I doubt, but they, to me, they are of a piece. Because I look at the three of these and I say, this show was as brilliant as any television has ever been. And that is why, like I said, I put a week space between the Smile and Jack episode and then The More I See You and then these three, because I never tire of watching these three shows. I just feel like they are MASH at its absolute best. Now, for you, again, before we get to the plot of this one, where are you in terms of the eras of MASH? Do you have like, is the B.J. Potter Frank years kind of more your favorite? The Winchester years a little bit, or the early ones with Trapper and Henry?
I really would like to appear on more than one episode on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. So I have a prepared statement about how the best serial narrative storytelling in Western civilization is actually the fourth season of MASH. But
there you go.
Yeah, no, seriously, I do love this season, and I'm not one of the guys whose favorites is the early episodes with Trapper, although I love Trapper and Henry, and I've actually, I mean, spoken about my appreciation for Henry in the comments section recently, but really, my best era is when Winchester is there, because I think he is a much more effective foil for Hawkeye and BJ, because as you see, even in this episode, Frank just becomes a caricature of a jerk, and it's hard to sustain that character. And I think Larry Linville knew that, whereas Winchester had lots of redeeming qualities, and the relationship that started between him and Klinger as these friends from different sides of the tracks. And it got a little more somber, but I still appreciated it.
Yes, absolutely. I would say, to me, MASH never got funnier than it did in seasons 4 and 5, but it is a more rounded show with Winchester, because of course there was a lot more dimensions to his character. And, you know, we'll get to it in season 5 about what maybe they could have done with Frank Burns, or maybe what they were never going to do with Frank Burns. As we've been talking about throughout the season, some of Frank Burns's worst moments are this season. I mean, he's
absolutely,
from the Novocaine mutiny, where he doesn't know how to prep patients for surgery, or, you know, where he talks about how all Asians are treacherous because they look alike. You know, I mean, he's just hard, or the way he talks to his wife, Louise, he just bullshits her and then laughs about it. I mean, in every respect, he's just so awful this season.
I couldn't agree more. And this is something I've said in the comments, so I might be saying that too many times tonight, but Frank is someone to be pitied in addition to someone who just annoys the heck out of you. I mean, when he talks about his family life growing up, and you know, how he turned into a snitch and all these things, and if he were a real person, you'd really have to do something, and you'd have to do something about how bad he is at medicine. You'd have to do something about how disruptive he is to the camp and camp morale. And you'd have to do something because the guy really needs help. And you go through all these seasons where they can't do something because they still need Frank around.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. They need at least Four doctors. Yeah, I mean, if Frank Burns was alive today, he'd be on television telling people not to get vaccinated. I think that's who he would be. He would be saying, you know, I'm a doctor, and I could tell you, don't get vaccinated, anybody. I feel like that's what Frank Burns would be if he was around today. But we'll deal with that, some of Frank's other moments as we move on through season four and then to season five. So, all right. So let's talk about Deluge. As I mentioned, it's episode 23. So the plot is a massive deluge of wounded hits the 477th, and all the various cases are intercut with actual black and white newsreel footage from the time. Some of it important and newsworthy, some of it silly, like a ping pong playing cat. In addition to the casualties, landmines start to explode, set off by the extreme weather changes outside. News breaks that China has ruptured the UN's front line, kicking off, quote, an entirely new war. The news gets so bad that orders are sent for all the nurses to be shipped out temporarily. But Margaret refuses to leave, even in the face of this great danger. She feels so strongly, she walks in the middle of Colonel Potter taking a shower, demanding she and the nurses stay. I was born to serve, Colonel. You must let me. Potter reluctantly agrees. Tensions start to flare, with Frank prattling on about how he's happy the Chinese have entered the war, and now the U.S. can, quote, obliterate them all. To make things worse, a carelessly tossed cigarette starts a fire in pre-op, which Rader and Klinger struggle to put out. They finally do, arriving in OR just in time for a bomb to go off just outside, blowing out the OR's windows and causing chaos. Eventually, though, the deluge subsides, leaving everyone exhausted. Potter walks in on Margaret as she is showering, leaving a bewildered Frank waiting outside and thanking her for staying. So, obviously, you know, that's one of the shorter synopses for these MASH episodes, because to me, as much as there's a lot of great scenes and some great jokes, and we'll talk about all that, what the reason this episode is so memorable is of course the format busting, the editing. You know, it is intercutting throughout these 24 minutes with this newsreel footage, and in some cases it doesn't even really seem to kind of match what we're seeing or really have any connection to what we're seeing, but that's part of the sort of weird discordant notes to it. And so a lot of this really is the style of the episode, not so much what happens to it in any given point. Overall, we're going to talk this about this scene by scene, Captain, but overall, like, do you remember what your impression was like when you first saw this one, or at least as you got older, like what you thought of this episode?
I thought it was really interesting because so my dad's in his 80s. I apologize for the dog barking in the background. So this would be a time frame when he would have seen these newsreels, right? So I thought it was interesting to see a glimpse into what not just the MASH representation of life was back like then, but what life really was like back then. So that was interesting, and it didn't bother me so much. I could see the parallels, and at the same time, I could also see the incongruity. When you are deployed, one of the things that you have to remember is that life is going on back home. I read a story, a book of true stories about Vietnam, and a SEAL was writing that he had been in a firefight at night looking up at the moon when his higher headquarters came over the radio, the people he was talking to for support, and said, hey, somebody just landed on the moon, talking about the Apollo 11 mission.
Wow.
Yeah. And he couldn't wrap his mind around that those two things were happening in the same universe. And I had a similar experience, what we called A-Day during Operation Iraqi Freedom. You had the massive air assault, the shock and awe assault that went into Baghdad, which was at the time arguably the most heavily defended city from an air defense perspective in the world. And I came off like a 13-hour shift, but I was still in this air operations center looking at all these tracks on the big screens on the wall. And I'm too keyed up to just go back to my tent and go to sleep. So I start trying to figure out what else I can do. It's like, oh, and at this time I had a week, or every week I could get a 15-minute phone call home, and the bandwidth is tremendously better now, and you can communicate whenever you like. But at the time in 2003, that was what we were dealing with. So I was like, oh, I'll make my 15-minute phone call. So I called home, and I think my wife remembers this story differently and probably more correctly, but I'll tell it the way I remember it. She had her aunt visiting, and they had decided to redecorate the kitchen. And she was telling me in detail about the new curtains and the new pot holders and this and that. And she was really excited about it. And I was trying to appreciate that. At the same time, I was still in that room looking up at those tracks going into Baghdad, waiting to see if any of them were going to blink out, you know? And the different realities we were living in was very apparent to me. And you see that with these newsreels.
Yeah. Wow. That's really amazing. I mean, again, I've never been in the military. I've never served, but it reminds me of that scene I saw. It's at the end of The Hurt Locker. I assume you've seen that movie, or maybe not. But that's
I haven't, but I know the scene you're talking about.
Yeah, the scene at the end where what's his name? Hawkeye.
Jeremy Renner.
Yeah, Jeremy Renner is food shopping, and he's opening the freezer to get like frozen dinners, and he's just looking at the endless choices of food in front of him that we all live with every day of our lives. And this is a guy that just came from where every decision was life or death. And now he's faced with, you know, endless choices over the most meaningless thing possible, which is like, you know, which Salisbury steak dinner to get. And he's frozen. He just can't decide because everything seems so different than what he was just experiencing. And, you know, it's an amazing moment. And for someone like me, again, who doesn't have that experience, that scene at least really put that across of like, wow, what, you know, how different the world feels to somebody who came from where they came from. So that's, were you able to convey that to your wife, or did you sort of keep that to yourself in the moment?
In the moment, I kept it to myself because I was actually trying to be engaged. You know, I didn't have much of an opportunity to be present with her. So I was trying to take advantage of the opportunity to do that. But we talked about it after I got back home. And there were a lot of things like that, that like, you know, with the rest of us on both sides, the rest of the story will be told once we're home, but together. But that scene that you talk about in Hurt Locker, the reason, even though I haven't seen that movie, the reason I know that scene is because we all talk about that scene.
Okay. Well, all right. Obviously, a very effective moment then, at least for in that scene, at least. So the show opens with some footage of Winston Churchill talking about the Korean War and over some stock footage. There's that shot it uses of radar jumping off the ambulance on the helipad, which they've used in like a half dozen episodes to this point. And they would even use it in the very next episode, the interview.
Yeah, so that little interstitial newsreel was really interesting because it's clearly taken place in the first couple months of the war and before the deluge they're talking about, because he talks about only three or four battalions. So that's the very beginning of the war when there were hardly any American troops there and the South Korean forces were heavily underarmed, and the North Korean army really pushed them nearly into the sea, down to the Southern Peninsula. And then in September, MacArthur comes in and does the amphibious landing at Incheon and under the UN command. And that turns the tide of the war, at least temporarily. And they push all the way back north up almost to the border with China. And it looks like it's going to be a complete rout. And then China comes in the war. And what happens when that happens is really what this episode's about.
Right. And so after the footage of Winston Churchill talking, we have Hawkeye and BJ and Frank preparing for surgery. And Frank complains that he didn't think there would be more wounded coming, which is, you know, come on, Frank. You know, what did you think? And then there's this headline where it says Korean War end. Obviously, that's not about to happen. So after that, there is some footage of can you explain, do you know this footage of what it is? If it's the narration says a spectacular display of rocket firepower. And I'm guessing it's a naval ship firing.
Yeah. So I didn't know anything about Wonsan Harbor until I was starting to prepare for this episode. But thanks to you, I've developed, and MASH, of course, I've developed a lot more expertise on the Korean War. But so during the time period that it's talking about, which is probably October, November, maybe into December, where the Chinese army was streaming across the border and pushing our forces, the UN command, down into South Korea, there were a couple actions that happened on at Wonsan Harbor, which is kind of in the southeast coast of North Korea. That's probably not what they're showing. They're probably showing what happened the following spring when Wonsan Harbor was under siege by the UN forces, and they sent something like a bazillion rockets. I think that was the official military number into Wonsan Harbor. So it was crazy. And so when I started reading about that, I thought, okay, this has to be like the April timeframe that they were talking about of the following year.
That the one thing that I think about when I watch that footage of the, you know, it's all dark and then it's only lit by the explosion of the missile launching is there's a great documentary about Stanley Kubrick, and it's narrated by Tom Cruise. It's about 2.5 hours long. It's, you know, it talks about his whole career. And there's a clip in it, the writer, I believe, of the book, The Short Timers, which Kubrick based his movie Full Metal Jacket on. And he talks about that Stanley Kubrick was, in his estimation, was one of the few filmmakers to make a war movie that was willing to admit within the confines of his film that at times war can be quite beautiful. Of course, you hear someone say that, and it sounds absurd to say that war is, you know, war can be beautiful. But I have to say, when you look at that footage, if you can forget what, you know, what's happening is that they are firing missiles that are going to land somewhere and kill a bunch of people. The sheer visuals of it is really quite spectacular. And the narration says that, you know, a brilliant display of rocket firepower. It really is quite gorgeous to look at in some ways.
No, you're right. And I mean, you know, the fireworks displays are supposed to evoke battle, right? And because of that, I don't take fireworks displays the same way I did when I was a kid. But you're right. The beauty is there and doesn't change. And, you know, but when we look at nature, lots of things that are beautiful are deadly.
Yes. As we get older, we learn these things. But yeah, I have to say, I remember that when I was a kid, I would watch this episode and I would see that clip. And I felt, it just felt strange because I'm like, boy, that's really amazing looking. And I would feel bad about it, you know. And then I heard that quote. I'm like, well, all right. Yeah, at least, again, if you forget the context, it's really an amazing piece of footage to see total darkness and then lit only by the shell going out of the cannon. It's really amazing. So then we cut back to the 477 and we find Colonel Potter is talking to some colonel and he's trying to get information from this guy about can they expect more casualties. And apparently this colonel is not forthcoming with any information. And Potter, and then in fact, the conversation goes so badly that this colonel hangs up on Colonel Potter. And then he turns around and calls them, he says, creeps. And Radar's like, who, sir? And he says, colonels, you can't trust them. They're this far, and he has his fingers, from making general. They can taste those stars. He makes the observation that captains and majors are okay because they're too far away, and that, you know, they don't have to make points. And then he says, and generals usually relax once they've made it. So I don't know how much of experience you've had with generals, but do you feel like that is an a true observation of Colonel Potter's?
I think the general part is true. And I mean, and as he points out, there are exceptions. But I'll make two quick observations about colonels. I haven't had the same experience that he had. They're much more of a mixed bag. But colonels, to me, I mean, and it's a big deal of a rank to be a full colonel like Colonel Potter is. Everyone that I've met and worked closely with, I could see the quality in them that made the promotion board want to promote them. And whatever that was, for some person, it would be a relentless drive. For another person, it would be their concern for the troops. For, you know, for one person, it would be his intellect. But that said, there are always those colonels who had plenty of other negative qualities that kind of overrode it. But the boards don't always see that. And the thing I will say about generals is almost without exception, they have amazing people skills. Mm. They can turn them off when they want to and turn them on when they want to. But the saying is that by the time you make general officer, you are both a soldier and a politician.
Right. Okay. So then we move to a scene in surgery, and BJ requests help from Colonel Potter, where he says, I got a bad belly wound, got an arterial pumper Which is a wonderfully lurid description. I always thought that would make a great band name, Arterial Pumper. And we see one of the more graphic displays of the effects of surgery I'd say MASH has ever done, where after we see a clip from the comedian Joe E. Brown talking about visiting the boys over there, doing a swell job out there protecting us here at home, and he requests Americans give blood. But and then we see, you know, the results of how blood is needed, where this geyser of blood shoots out of this patient and splashes BJ in the face to the point where it hits him in the eye, and they have to get him away from the table, and Colonel Potter has to take over, and Father Mulcahy has to irrigate his eyes, Colonel Potter expresses. But MASH didn't, other than, you know, blood on the gloves and some stuff here and there, they generally didn't get too graphic, because, of course, this was television in the 70s. But, man, I guess they were able to, you know, under the sort of rubric of being real and being sort of almost educational in a way, man, that is, you know, that's pretty nasty to show, you know, TV viewers at like 8:30 on a Saturday night after like the Mary Tyler Moore Show, to see a big spurt of blood hit one of your main characters in the face.
It is, and they probably caused some upset stomachs, but I think for the shot and for the scene, it was worth it, because you got to see Colonel Potter's willingness to help. You got to see BJ's willingness to accept help and his total security as a surgeon, yep, which is the opposite of Frank, who takes, you know, everything as an insult sometimes. And then you got to see Father Mulcahy and the way he pitches in, and he's calm under pressure.
Yep.
And even though this isn't his job, he does whatever needs to be done. So I thought it was a great scene.
It is great. And Father Mulcahy makes a joke to help, relax BJ a little bit. It's a really great scene. So then we cut to pre-op, where Margaret is telling Klinger what to do in terms of getting the personal effects of everybody. And she talks to a soldier, and this soldier is played by the actor. His name is Tom Rubin. He had a lot of TV credits. He was on a show called CPO Sharky with Don Rickles. He was in the movie More American Graffiti and an episode of Shazam. He's talking to Margaret, and he explains, he says, "My personal effects, I already gave them to a guy outside." And Margaret says, "You've been robbed, soldier." And I got to say, Captain, as a kid, even as an adult, this scene still really shocks me. Not that any level of human behavior is shocking to me anymore, I guess, because I know how bad people can be. But I don't know, the idea that someone would rob a wounded soldier as they're lying there on a stretcher, they would use that moment to rob them of whatever couple of bucks they had in their pocket, is so catastrophically despicable that I guess on some level it still does shock me. And it must have gone on. It must have happened. I don't think MASH was making this up, but man, it still just does feel really shocking that someone is that low that they would do that. And presumably it's an American that was doing it, because this soldier wouldn't give his personal effects to probably someone that didn't look like they belonged there. So this is a fellow American robbing a wounded soldier. I mean, it's just really gut-wrenching.
Yeah, I have pretty much the same reaction you do. And what I mean is, I'm not surprised, but I am deeply morally offended. But you're right, it happens, because, you know, the soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, Guardians, now that we have a Space Force, you know, they're all still people. And they're, we're drawing from the populace at large, and you will see the most noble things you have ever seen in a combat zone, and you will see despicable things like this. And it does remind me of a joke that the Marine Corps has. They say there's only one thief in the Marine Corps, but the problem is he gets around.
Wow. So that scene didn't shock you? It was something you just kind of like, yeah, that happened?
Yeah. And I mean, and maybe when I was 25 and new in the service and, you know, bright-eyed and innocent, it would have shocked me more. I would have complained and said, oh, that's not realistic, that wouldn't happen, but not now.
Wow. Wow. Oh, man, that is grim. So after that, there is some documentary footage of President Truman giving a talk. And, with you know, another moment where MASH's timeline is completely out of whack, because as of Deluge here, which is at the end of season four, President Truman is president. And, of course, we learned in the late Captain Pierce, which was the fourth episode of season four, that Eisenhower was president. So which is it, MASH? Is Truman still president, or is it now Eisenhower? But again, they just didn't worry about that stuff.
Yeah, and this is actually the most out of whack of the newsreel footage, because what they're showing is a whistle stop in the 1948 presidential campaign. So it's, I think all the others are from 1950 or 1951, based on what I looked up. So they're pretty close, but 48's a little bit out there. But the other thing I noticed about the newsreel is how many people are talking to one another on the dais behind President Truman as the president is talking.
Oh, and I never noticed that.
Yeah, I guess it's only a couple people talking to one another, and there's a guy in a uniform who's shuffling in his seat, and it just, that's not how you're supposed to act when you're...
Yeah, I would imagine that would not be cool. That would not be cool. I'll have to look for that next time I watch this episode. I've never noticed that before. So yeah, obviously, yeah, 1948, they're a bit off in their timeline here, but I guess they're assuming most people would know that. You know, yeah. They just needed it for the clip. So they just wanted a clip of Harry Truman talking. So now we're in post-op. Father Mulcahy is flagged down by a soldier who's wounded. And he talks about how that while he was out there on the line, he prayed to God, say, God, if you get me out of this, I'm going to become a priest. And Father Mulcahy, you know, leads him. He leads into the line. He says, and he got you out of it. And then he's like, Father, I don't want to be a priest. And Father Mulcahy, he basically, you know, lets him off the hook and says, you know, don't worry about it. If everyone that was in a moment of crisis who promised to join the priesthood carried through, as he says, it looked like we had a population explosion, which, of course, he realizes is kind of a funny phrase to use. And he basically reassures this young soldier that don't worry about it. That God will forgive you. Now, this actor playing this unnamed soldier is Cario Salem. He would return to MASH in the season 10 show, Concerns of the Living, Follies of the Dead, playing the dead soldier, the soldier who dies at the beginning of the episode. And we follow his quote unquote ghost through the rest of the episode. So that's the same actor. They brought him back for that episode. And I can't wait to talk about that one 6 years from now, because it's a great episode. He also had some movie credits, but mainly is the, I know him from that other episode of MASH. And then, so after Father Mulcahy leaves, Radar comes by with a tray, and he says, do you have a stomach wound? And this soldier says, no. He says, he got hit in the leg. And he says, oh, you can have a beer. And this young soldier says, I'd rather have some scotch. And Radar kind of admonishes him and says, you're too young to drink. Since when is beer not drinking?
Well, I guess Radar has different standards. But the other funny thing about that is that, you know, Radar is probably the same age as this guy.
Yeah, you're right. But and he's dispensing, you know, it.
Yeah, he. I think he thinks of himself as a grizzled veteran at this point.
Yeah, I guess he does. I guess things are getting, you know, a little loose at the 477th when there's this much going on that you can give the guy, you know, these poor soldiers get so few treats. I guess a beer is not that big of a deal in the grand scheme of things. So after that, there is a scene in, I don't know exactly where we are here. It's some sort of scrub room. It's connected to the hospital, but it's this monologue by Klinger, and he's talking to Goldman, Playboy Roy Goldman. And now Goldman does not get a line, but it's this whole scene of Jamie Farr just sort of waxing nostalgic about his days back in Toledo and how he ended up getting drafted into the Army and how he tried to sort of like purposely act crazy during the induction process. And there's a line about, he says, you know, they told me, you keep this up, I'll make you an officer. It's a weird scene because to me, it's very conspicuous that Goldman never talks. It seems so strange to me that he's just listening, and it's just almost like Klinger doing like a stand-up routine, but nevertheless, it's a very funny routine, and I'll be talking about it later on, But I guess it's the whole reason they even have the scene is to lead us into what happens right after that, where Hawkeye and BJ bring in the patient with the phosphorus burn so they can dump him in a tub. So they built this whole set. We don't think we ever see this set again, because again, it's not even really sure where we are here in the camp, but it's, I guess it's done just for what we're going to learn about the patient with the phosphorus burns.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they're in the kitchen, which is a little gross if you think about it, but it's
just, yeah.
But the, and I know you're going to talk about this scene later, but I'll just get this in while I can. To me, this is the best and most comedic performance of the episode. Jamie Farr is in vaudeville form.
He's very funny.
Lighting in the kitchen like he's on stage. He's got his scarf on. Roy doesn't seem to mind that he's doing 90% of the work because he's enjoying the show. So it was just a neat performance.
He wanted to drop everything from an A-bomb to a Z-bomb. He just he is very, very funny here. So then, except, as I mentioned, Hawkeye and BJ show up, and the patient has phosphorus burns. And what they've determined is the way that these burns are going to work is if they hit the air, they are going to basically explode and set the GI on fire, which is, you know, incredibly grim. And so they know how to get around it by pouring this powder on they dump the soldier in a tub of water, and then they pour this powder on him. And he mentions this stuff coats and neutralizes the little bits of phosphorus still in the leg. And I love Klinger has the line about, how do you guys remember all this stuff? And Hawkeye says, you wear earplugs so it doesn't leak out, which is great. And then they turn the lights off, and we see the effect of this powder, where the remaining bits of phosphorus material glow like lightning bugs. And we see these little tweezers come out and pull them out, and that is the way to safely get rid of this stuff without risking the soldier's life of being burned. And it's a really great scene, because it's like, you learn something. I never forgot this after I saw it like the first time. I thought it was so fascinating that, you know, like a surgeon would have to know this. I mean, this seems a little bit beyond. I mean, obviously, if you're a doctor who's fighting in a war, you're going to learn things that a regular doctor back home would never have to learn. But nevertheless, it almost seems like, wow, they really have to know this stuff. They have to, as Klinger says, how do you remember all this stuff? Like, how do they keep track of all this stuff, of all the different ways weapons of war can mangle bodies? It really makes them, the way that Hawkeye and BJ tackle it so sort of matter-of-factly, to me it's really a heroic scene, because they just handle it so beautifully.
Yeah, I agree. And I reacted the same way to all the science of it. It does seem like hardcore chemistry.
Yeah.
Beyond kind of what you would expect a medical doctor to be doing. But, you know, once they invent these procedures, then they share the information so everybody else has it. And I invaded Dr. Lewis's and Dr. Ange's territory and Googled medical data, which I know is always dangerous. But I found out that this is really what they do. And it's been over 100 years that they've been doing it. The only difference that I found was the stuff I saw said that the copper sulfate turns the phosphorus black, or when it reacts, it makes cupric sulfate, I think. I can't remember. Anyway, no, cupric phosphate. So it turns it black instead of it glowing. But that seems like a weird thing to get wrong, especially when they had MASH, you know, actual surgeons as technical advisors.
Right.
So I'm awaiting Dr. Ainge and Dr. Lewis to tell me why I'm mistaken.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Ainge, Chris, you heard the man. Chime in and let us know whether what the skinny is on that. So after that, we get some more newsreel footage, and we have French fights Reds in Vietnam. And of course, now that was going on around this time, but you know, I'm sure MASH could not resist the chance to get the phrase Vietnam into the show, even though it is historically correct. Nevertheless, we all know that what MASH was really talking about. But again, I feel like that when they probably found that piece of footage, just the word Vietnam blaring there in big type, they probably just could not resist.
Yeah, I agree. It was obvious foreshadowing. And it's weird. I think Dien Bien Phu, or the battle where the French lost and weren't able to maintain their colony in French Indochina then, I think that happened in 54. So it's not far off.
All right. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, it's pretty timeline accurate. After that, we go back to surgery, and there is a really grim scene where Radar brings in a patient, and he asks BJ to take good care of him because he's from Iowa. And BJ just takes a look and takes the young man's pulse, and then just simply says, he's not from Iowa anymore. And Radar disgustedly grabs the IV bottle, and they take the body out. I guess the idea that they're trying to put across is that the pressure is mounting, and they are so busy that BJ just doesn't, it's not that he doesn't have the time to soften the blow. It's just, he doesn't even think to because he's so busy, but it's a very un-BJ like line to just say it. So sort of casual, he's not from Iowa anymore. It's like, wow, that's a really cold way of putting it.
Yeah. I don't like the line either. And it doesn't even really make sense.
Iowa, whether he's dead or alive, he's still from Iowa.
Yeah. But what saves that scene is Radar's reaction, because he sells his anger.
Yeah, the way he grabs the IV bottle and just looks horrified, and he knows he doesn't have time to really react to it. So then we see that a nurse informs Hawkeye that he has left a sponge in, and of course Burns cannot resist, getting in on that. And I really like Margaret's reaction, where she just goes, not now, Major. First of all, we're all really busy. We don't have time for this nonsense. And also, who the hell is Burns to ever make a comment about some mistake Hawkeye might have made? His attitude is, as he says, I just want to see if Dr. Perfect can take it as well as he dishes it out, which is not entirely unfair, I guess. But nevertheless, it's like, you got to pick and choose your moments, Frank. And this is not the right moment.
Yeah, well, and obviously none of us take it as well as we dish it out.
But, yeah.
But and your point about Margaret is a really good one, because this is Margaret in transition, right?
Yep.
And that's exactly her. She's not coming down on Frank like a ton of bricks, but she's not putting up with his nonsense either.
Yeah, I really like that in her, that she just is like, come on, let's just move off with this. So then Potter tells a story about what can get stuck in the human body. And there was like a dried apricot that a relative of his took. And then she drank some water, and the apricot expanded back to its original size and ruptured. And he's like, lodged in her duodenum, and he had to perform an apricot. And then we get over the PA, this announcement where they talk about how the Chinese have ruptured the U.S. line. He says the Chinese have attacked with 33 divisions. That is 300,000 men, folks. And he says, according to headquarters, we face an entirely new war. And even Frank, who talks about how he loves it at the 477, even Frank looks kind of horrified. And I wonder what, I guess they have to tell everybody this because it's news, but I almost wonder, why would you tell them this? Because that's just nothing but demoralizing.
Yeah, and I would make the same conclusion. You have to tell them. And it also, it makes the difference to what they can expect, right? Mm. I mean, what you're dealing with right now, this isn't one battle where there's going to be a lot of wounded. There's going to be a lot of wounded for a while.
Mm.
And so they need to know that, and they need to mentally prepare for that. They need to stock up, all those things. But I agree with you about Frank's reaction. And what's interesting, since we've all lived a chunk of our lives in masks now, is seeing how much they're conveying, how much acting they're doing, when the only thing you can see is their eyes.
Yeah. Yeah. As I said, we see Potter react to it. They all react to it. And then of course Hawkeye has a great joke where the nurse finds the missing sponge, and he goes, Dojene. And speaking Chinese, saying that's Chinese for thank you, no sense wasting time, which is a great dark joke, saying that they're all going to be speaking Chinese sooner rather than later. And that's the act break of the show. And then we come back and we get some more newsreel footage of some ballroom dancers. And this is kind of the beginning, I'd say the second half of this episode really starts leaning heavily on what's going on at home while our heroes are dealing with this. And it leads to a really interesting sequence, a montage, which MASH really never did, where over footage of Hawkeye taking care of soldiers out on the compound and giving instructions to Radar about who's going to go in what order, we get this music, the ballroom dancing music, which is purposefully loud and kind of, you know, fanciful. And obviously you're meant to dance to it. And it's meant to be completely discordant with what we're seeing. It's meant to be silly and light. Meanwhile, we're watching Hawkeye dealing with, you know, body after body of you know, laying out on the compound. And I'm always fascinated because if you listen closely enough, you can hear Alan Alda talking to Gary Berghoff. You can hear him speaking. Now, if you watch the show with the subtitles on, they don't give you any of the dialogue. But nevertheless, he is saying something. And so that means they did shoot this scene with dialogue. I would love to know what that dialogue was. It's probably fairly standard stuff. But I like the idea that you can almost sort of hear it a little bit. It gives it to me even more of a verisimilitude that, yeah, they actually are talking. But to me, this scene is, you know, the real contrast of look at what we're dealing with versus what people are doing back at home.
Yeah, I agree with you. The this is when I should have told those stories. So because it really is the point of contrast. The other two things that stood out about this scene, I read somewhere in the process of boning up for this that Larry Gelbart said they added in the newsreel footage after they figured out they didn't have enough footage for this episode.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. So that means that he looked at this footage, you know, somewhere in the process of looking at all this newsreel footage as they were scrambling to fill time and they had this idea of how to do it. He saw these dancers and realized it looked like the dance of triage that Radar and Hawkeye were doing. It was an accidental matchup, not an intentional one. So that was interesting to me. And then the other thing is that there's one point in that where Hawkeye's hunched over a patient and Radar is too, and Hawkeye is getting up, kind of turning to move to the next patient. And he puts his hand on Radar and pivots off of him. And it just showed how familiar they were with each other and how comfortable they were with each other. And I thought that was neat.
Oh yeah. That's really nice. Yeah. It's one of those things that I've seen a million times. And I never really thought about it. So you just pointed it out, but yeah, it does have a slight dancing feel to it a little bit. So, but that's amazing that it was sort of accidental. I mean, again, this episode to me is so smooth and so brilliant that I never would have guessed that was something they sort of discovered later on in the editing process. That's just amazing. So then Hawkeye goes up onto the bus and Father Mulcahy is giving the last rites to someone. And he even says, you know, he finds this in his wallet. He says he was going to go on to leave, going on leave to Tokyo tomorrow. And Hawkeye says, and so we will. And I find it interesting that Hawkeye trusts Father Mulcahy because he doesn't even really check on this guy. Father Mulcahy is giving him the last rites. Hawkeye kind of does like a quick look, really, but he doesn't really examine him in any serious way. And I mean, you would think that he should, because they don't put dead people on the buses and send them to the 477th. But he obviously trusts Mulcahy on some respect that, okay, if Father Mulcahy is giving this kid the last rites, he must really be dead, and I'm not going to waste time on him, as opposed to somebody else he can look at. But I mean, it's sort of interesting. He doesn't even take the kid's pulse to just triple check. Now, maybe that's not the right thing, but to me, it says something about that he trusts Mulcahy to that extent.
Yeah, I agree. I wonder just how much Father Mulcahy, how much medical knowledge he picked up. Because you see these episodes that were mostly about surgery, and he's all over the place doing all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And I think recently there was one episode where they put him in charge of prepping people for surgery, which you pointed out, it isn't terribly realistic.
Yeah, the Novocaine Mutiny. Yeah, he goes in, he takes over for Frank.
Yeah, and you wonder, like, okay, in his next assignments as a Catholic priest, you know, what did he do with all his medical knowledge? Did he go off to did he go to Africa and do missionary? Yeah. Work. I mean, I wonder about the rest of his story.
Well, yeah, I mean, and boy, that's something we can talk about years from now when we follow up with Aftermash cast.
Yes,
we talk about that show. But I've always been very upset that Aftermash. We're getting way afield here, but since it's on my mind at the moment, I've always been very bothered by the fact that Aftermash never got a final episode. The show was just canceled, And so these three beloved characters, Colonel Potter, Father McKay, and Klinger, were just never seen again. And we don't get like a final story for them. And that always bothered me because it's, to me, it's like, these were some of the best characters TV ever had. They deserved a better send off than to just disappear, you know, kind of thing. I would have liked to have seen some sort of conclusion to our characters, but that's a complaint for an episode for another day. So then we get some newsreel footage and we see General MacArthur. After he has been relieved of duty and he has gets a ticker tape parade in New York and he delivers a speech. Now, where is this? I know that, you know, Harry Truman fired MacArthur and it was a very controversial decision because MacArthur was very popular and Truman was not. Timeline wise, where does this fit?
Well, so if I remember correctly, he fired MacArthur in April of 1951. So it would have been several months after the deluge. And so I assumed, I didn't dig into when the ticker tape parade happened. I assumed it happened probably shortly after that as MacArthur returned home. So it's kind of a gutsy move to do a ticker tape parade for a general who just got fired, mm-hmm. which really shows you where MacArthur stood in history. And the fact that even though President Truman said he was wrong and Congress said he was wrong, you know, they still needed to celebrate everything he had accomplished. So that was interesting to me. The other two thoughts I had looking at that were who cleans all this up? and that female cop who's standing behind General MacArthur, is that the one who dated the Submariner?
Oh my God. Wow. That was, it took me a second, Captain. That's a deep cut.
Sorry. She just looked exactly like the way she was portrayed in those, you know, 1940 comics.
We need to go back and check that out. Well, that was wow, Captain. Wow. Okay. I'm going to need a moment. So now we're back at surgery and, Frank is blathering on saying he's glad that the Chinese have finally gotten into the show and he says, we'll obliterate them all. And of course, BJ says all 600 million, Frank. And Frank then offers, well, most of them don't want to be Reds anyway. And BJ says, then why kill them? And then Byrne says, well, they can't have it both ways, which is just complete gibberish. It doesn't make any sense at all, but is unfortunately very typical of Frank Burns. And of course, Potter has the line in a moment saying, make sure you don't sew up any contaminated wounds because I know how hard it is to be a doctor and Secretary of State at the same time.
Yeah. It is a great nonsensical Frank line, and it's so nonsensical that you can't argue with it. So they just have to let it go.
It's horrifying that a doctor, I know they're human like anybody else and they have their feelings about politics and war, but nevertheless, it is really horrifying that you would have a doctor who is sort of gleefully, you know, romantically thinking of the idea of killing 600 million people. Like that to him is a good thing. You would think as a doctor that doesn't, you shouldn't want to see that happen as a physician.
I agree. It's also kind of somber to think about and not sure if you'll want to leave this in or not, because it's a bit of a downer, but a lot of Chinese soldiers died in Korea. And of course, you know, you can argue they didn't have to come in into the war. They were on the wrong side. They were supporting communist North Korea that had initiated a war of aggression, et cetera, et cetera. But those soldiers didn't have that choice. They were generally conscripted. And they were going at the United Nations command, America and like 20 other nations, and doing it without the arms that they needed to do it and in these human wave types of tactics. Anyway, the loss of life was tremendous. So we didn't obliterate all 600 million like Frank wanted, but it was horrible.
Mm. Oh my Lord. So after there's a scene with Radar where he talks about that, the supply line is jammed and he has to make some phone calls to get some plasma and some other things. And he also talks about that his glasses are broken. So he's has a hard time seeing through things. We see Klinger go and take some laundry in pre-op and throw it into a basket. And there's a soldier sitting there smoking a cigarette, which of course will come into play shortly. And he's got a gun and he's just sitting there. And this this actor is a guy named Anthony Palmer. He had a couple notable roles. He played Richard Nixon in a TV movie called J. Edgar Hoover, about J. Edgar Hoover. And he was in another TV movie called Ruby and Oswald. So obviously he was a guy that they thought about for the, you know, kind of historical pieces. And then he was in other movies like Panic in Needle Park with Al Pacino and Rancho Deluxe with Sam Waterston. So he had a pretty decent career. And he's sitting there smoking, and Hawkeye tells him to put it out. And the guy says, hey, I'm a sergeant fella. And then Hawkeye says, and I'm a captain fella, which means if we explode, I'm going to fly higher than you. And, you know, this is, you can count on one hand and across 11 seasons the amount of times Hawkeye ever pulled rank. But he does it here because, and it's in the service of, you know, safety, is that he's saying you can't be smoking right outside where we've got oxygen tanks and things like that.
Yeah, and he, of course, he's completely justified, and the sergeant is a moron. And and you talked before about how Frank, if he were alive today, would be telling people not to get vaccinated. My thought when I watched this post-pandemic was, there's no way this guy's wearing a mask. He would be the guy arguing against it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So then we have a scene with Radar trying to order some stuff. There's a great line where the ceiling starts to drip. And he says, we got rain here. I wonder why the army ordered that, which is a great line. And then he's trying to make some trades, and he talks about we got rolls of toilet paper. He's not really getting anywhere. And then we have the scene in the shower where Margaret comes in to talk to Colonel Potter, even while he's getting a shower. And she's like, Colonel, I need to see you. And he goes, one step closer, you'll get the whole picture. And she talks about that because the as Potter says, it's like the country sprang a leak, they got to evacuate the nurses. And this, you know, Margaret, Loretta Swit does not appear in the More ACU, and she does not appear in the interview. But she's in this episode. She's not in it a lot. But to me, this is her finest moment. And to me, this is one of Margaret's finest moments, where she explains, the service is my life. I was born in an army hospital. I was born to serve, Colonel. You must let me. And Loretta Swit really delivers it beautifully. I mean, she's almost in tears at the thought that when the going is getting rough, she would be shipped off to quote unquote safer confines. And she really, really sells it, both as the, you know, Loretta Swit as the actress to us, and Margaret sells it to Colonel Potter because Colonel Potter goes along with it. And reluctantly, but he does. But man, Loretta Swit is just great in this scene.
Okay, I'm going to say two good things about this scene, and I hope I don't ruin it for you, but one bad thing.
Okay.
So the good thing, you're right. Your good friend, Loretta Swit, she does a terrific performance in this scene. And as a military brat, everything that she's saying about being a military brat makes perfect sense to me, even though we kind of got out of that lifestyle by the time I was, getting anywhere in elementary school. I still saw enough of it and heard enough of about it from my older brother that all of that is valid, and it makes sense that it would be part of Margaret's character. Now, the negative is, that's not how she should have made the argument. So, in the military, and especially with somebody like Colonel Potter, the two priorities are the mission and the people. And Margaret obviously is one of those people that he cares about. But as the head nurse, she should have been making the argument about the wounded, because in this deluge, soldiers really will die without the nurse's care. BJ quotes I can't even remember all four of her names right now, the poet later, who is a women's rights activist and talked about the importance of nurses in war. And she was spot on. I mean, the soldiers will die without her.
Oh, Elizabeth Barrett Browning? Is that who he quotes?
No, something it's like when we get there, I'll see it in my notes. But that's the approach she should have taken, to me. And when she says she can take care of her nurses, or I can take care of my girls, against the onrushing Chinese army, that just seemed ridiculous to me.
That's completely fair. That is complete. I mean, yes, I think they wanted to do it because they wanted to give Loretta, as we say, Loretta Swit really is not in season four very much, because she was off doing a play, which is unfortunate because she missed a lot of great shows. So I think they wanted to turn this moment into a twofer between her and Potter. and specifically something for Margaret to do. But that is a completely fair observation that, yeah, she really should make it personal. It really should be more about what's best for the soldiers. And I'm willing to, you know, I need to be here because it's going to save lives, not because I don't, you know, because I was an Army brat and I want to serve. So I never thought of it that way, Captain.
Well, and, you know, and she could have gone into the rest of the stuff about her personally after she made her point and got Colonel Potter to agree.
Mm.
Just cut out one of the newsreels. But anyway.
Right. Right.
Monday morning quarterbacking.
Right, right, right. So, well, yes, 40 years later, we're Monday morning, but we're 40 years later quarterbacking. So then we get to another scene in surgery, and BJ asks for fresh gloves, and Klinger says, we don't have any more. We're out. We're completely out. And again, we know things are getting tense because BJ, he doesn't flip out, but he gets mad. And he says, you know, how can a hospital run out? How can we work without gloves? And he throws them down. And that, again, that, and he's yelling at Klinger, which, of course, is not Klinger's fault. But, I mean, that's how bad things are getting, that even the normally calm BJ is really pissed off. And I would be, too. Who the hell wants to stick your bare hand, aside from the health worries, just, you know, who wants to stick your bare hands into someone's guts? I mean, good luck ever getting that completely out of your fingernails.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But on the other hand, it's a great scene of just how many rules they would break in order to do their job.
Yeah, I mean, again, what could you do if you run out of gloves? What are you going to do? You can't not operate. So what are you going to do? You got to improvise. And so then that cuts to the silliest piece of stock footage that they've got, which is a cat, Dagwood, who plays ping pong. So again, sort of underscoring, you know, people back home aren't necessarily worrying about the war too much because we got a cat playing ping pong, and that's apparently newsworthy to watch in a newsreel is a cat playing ping pong. Meanwhile, again, our poor heroes are dealing what they're dealing with. We cut to Radar making another deal. He mentions he's going through his sheets about what he's got. And he mentions earlier about the toilet paper. And then he says, hey, we've got Tropic of Cancer. And he messes up the title Tropic of Capricorn. And he says, you know, they were published in France. Do I need to tell you anymore? And, of course, we know what he's referring to, the books by Henry Miller. I find it interesting that it appears that these books are on, like, the official 477th inventory. Like, they're on a sheet somewhere. It's not like Radar just says, oh, hey, you know, guess what? I have some books I could send you. It looks like it's actually part of, like, you know, on an actual sheet somewhere that these books were sent along. That does not seem like the kind of material the Army would be providing for its soldiers.
I have to think Radar has a separate sheet of things he's acquired that might be good for bargaining. And, you know, and there is the thing of, you know, once you're outside of America, you have access to things that you can't get in America. Like nowadays it would be Cuban cigars, right?
Sure.
So that happens, but those two books, I looked them up. I mean, I'd heard of them growing up, but they really were banned in the United States at that time. And it wasn't until 1961 that the Supreme Court declared them not obscene, which was funny for a couple of reasons. Number one, it was the Supreme Court justice's job to read these dirty novels and decide whether or not they were obscene. And then I saw a quote from the decision that basically said, it talks about sex. It does so in a vulgar, repulsive manner, but it's really not very good as pornography. And it does have literary value. Therefore, it's not obscene. So just the fact that was their job and that august body kind of cracks me up.
Sitting there reading dirty books. Yeah, that's very funny. Then we have Hawkeye and BJ and Father Mulcahy getting a quick snack. They're making some sandwiches. And here is the poem that BJ recites that you just mentioned. He says, a soldier of the Legion lay dying in Algiers. It was a lack of woman's nursing. There was a dearth of woman's tears. And it is Caroline Elizabeth Sarah Norton. Yes. Those are the names that he remembers. And then him and Hawkeye have this little conversation about going through school. They lead to a great joke about where he asks Hawkeye, "Do you know any poetry?" And Hawkeye says, "I got a butte, but not in front of the father," which is funny and very sweet. And then BJ, after Hawkeye makes the sandwich, Hawkeye says, "Look out, Dagwood," and he cleaves it in half with a cleaver. And he actually says, "Look out, Dagwood." Now, of course, Dagwood, he could be referring to Dagwood as in Blondie and Dagwood, and because Dagwood was famous for making these giant, you know, quadruple decker sandwiches. But the cat that we just saw in the footage is also named Dagwood. So it's the only sort of blend over where, you know, is that footage that somehow BJ saw? Like, you know, it's the only thing where you feel like, wait, are the members of the 4-7-7 actually seeing this footage like we are?
Yeah, well, I mean, and the footage was from 1950, I think. So So that's a possibility. But I also imagine Larry Gelbart and, you know, and the editing crew or whoever going through this footage and saying, "Hey, wait a minute, that cat's name is Dagwood. We can insert it, you know, before the sandwich scene." And and it also it amused me that in 1950, cat videos were already a thing.
Yeah, that's right. Cats are always popular and whatever social media we've got. So we're back in the pre-op room where we're back with that sergeant. And we see fairly subtly, you have to really pay attention to it, is that he has a lit cigarette and he dumps some ashes into the laundry basket. Nobody notices, but he does. And then we have a scene in surgery. And we see that Hawkeye is getting, as he says, barehanded surgery, and they're just pouring alcohol on his hands over some basins. I guess in the only way they really know how to get their hands sterile. So then we see that the laundry is starting to smoke. Radar notices it. He yells at Klinger to put it out. Klinger grabs a basin. I said basin twice. He grabs a basin of water. And unfortunately, it's not water, it's alcohol, which of course makes the fire that much worse, and it turns the smoke into a raging fire at that point. His doctors inside the operating room notice it. Frank says, "The laundry's on fire." And Hawkeye has the great line, "Oh, I was wondering when things were going to get interesting." And they say, "You know, is anybody handling it?" And he says, "O'Reilly and Klinger are working on it." And I love that Potter goes, he doesn't even look up. And he just goes, "It'll be fine."
Yes.
I love that. I love that he has faith in his men, that he just is like, okay, I don't have time to worry about this. And it's clearly covered if those two are taking it on. He's such a great leader.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And if you had not brought that up, I was going to. Mm.
Yeah, I love it. I love that he doesn't even look up from it. It's just absolutely fantastic. And so then the fire is raging. Then a water gets on a bulb above BJ's patient, and it causes the bulb to shatter. BJ has to lean over the patient to make sure glass doesn't get in the patient. And this is a rare moment where Frank is a good doctor, because he snaps into shape. He runs over to help BJ out, and he's yelling about, "Get more pickups." And he's doing the thing he's supposed to be doing. It doesn't happen much, but here's Frank actually being a good doctor.
Yeah, and it's like it's instinctive, and he forgets to be himself for a minute.
Yeah, it's really great. He's barking out orders to Father Mulcahy about what to do. It's great. It's a really great moment. Hawkeye is the great scene, great moment where he says to Colonel Potter, I hate to tell you this, Colonel, but I've got a better offer. And Potter's like, take me with you. Radar comes in. He says the fire's out. He's got a tray full of sandwiches. And then just to top off the episode, there's a massive explosion, which, as we've been hearing earlier, the weather patterns are constricting the ground, and it's causing the mines to go, the American mines to go off, and it blows all the windows in, and it's just utter chaos. And we get Radar yelling about how the sandwiches have been destroyed, and he's like, "It took me 3 weeks to requisition that. Holy cow!" And in a reversal of the scene earlier, where we had the music from the dance hall playing over the footage of Hawkeye, now they've reversed it, where we hear all the yelling, all the chaos going on in the operating room over the footage of the ballroom dancers. So they flop it, which I think is a nice little moment. And then we smash cut to the end. And, you know, look, I'm sure viewers in 1976, you know, were not as unsophisticated as maybe sometimes I imagine them to be or whatever. Nevertheless, this is a fairly hard edit and a sort of unromantic edit. Like the whole show just wraps up, bang, the end with this music. And again, I have to wonder what people were thinking in 1976 when they watched this, because MASH is not holding your hand here.
No, they're really not. But it kind of makes sense because, you know, after they're done with that scene or you're done with that deluge in the OR, that they're just going to go collapse. So there's no more story to tell.
Yeah. And so that's the end of the act. And then we come back for sort of the button scene where we just see the aftermath. Hawkeye and BJ look like utter zombies. We get a PA announcement where he talks about by the direction of the Secretary of the Army, the 477th has been issued the meritorious unit commendation due to their performance under pressure like this. So Hawkeye and BJ are just, again, zombies. Radar is flat out unconscious, having fallen asleep on his typewriter. Father McKay is still working. He's reading to two patients. And he's yawning, but he's reading. He's still working. Klinger, again, seemingly has his own tent. He's working on a dress. And then we see at the end, Burns is outside the showers drinking a cup of coffee. We don't exactly know what's going on. Potter walks right by him. Frank looks a little shocked, like, what's going on? And then we see, of course, Margaret is in there. And there's this initial moment where she looks shocked because, of course, you know, you're not supposed to walk in on a woman while she's showering. And Potter has got the 3-day stubble, which I think is a nice touch. And then he just says, I just want to thank you for staying. And that's the end of the episode. And it's a really sweet, nice moment, despite the fact that you've explained to me it wasn't the greatest argument that Margaret ever made. But it's a great, nice human moment to end this episode on.
If you'll indulge me, let me tell you an experience I had in Afghanistan about women's contribution in combat, because that's what this episode always makes me think of. And really Margaret's great smile at the end when she knows that the work that she and the nurses did, that Colonel Potter appreciated that so much. On my last two deployments to Afghanistan, I was filling what were called AFPAC hand assignments. And AFPAC hands was a program where they took people and gave them extra language and cultural training so they could work more effectively with the locals in Afghanistan or Pakistan, but mostly Afghanistan. So my first one of those assignments, I was assigned to a special operations task force in the western part of the country. Part of my job was to represent that task force to all local officials. So every time I went outside the wire, as we call it, I had to assemble a team of folks to join me for security. So I wasn't going alone. In the same vein of community relations, we also had small elements called cultural support teams that would go out with our fielded special operations teams. And these were composed of female service members whose job was to talk to women on the battlefield. Because in that culture in the villages, it was an insult for a man to strike up a conversation with someone's wife and daughter. So the cultural support teams, or CSTs, did a lot of civic action and development work, but they also had some direct combat experience because they were telling women in the villages things like, take your children and leave, there's about to be a raid, or please tell me more about where your husband and his friends went with all those weapons. And then they had gone through special training as well, including additional tactical training. So one day the officer in charge of the CSTs came to ask me if she could loan me a couple of her CST Marines, they happen to be Marines in this case, for one of my outings. She explained that they were new in theater and she wanted them to go outside the wire in a more benign environment before she sent them to a forward operating base. I immediately accepted the help and said I'd have them pull vehicle security. She asked if I had any problem having females pull vehicle security, and I said, no, absolutely not. They were armed, they're trained, in this case they happen to be Marines, so we were in good hands. In fact, I told her they were probably a better deterrent than male security because the average misogynist Taliban member would never want to go to paradise and explain how he got martyred by a girl. And that was an offhand comment. But so I had to submit my concept of operation to the operations director for approval to go on my little mission. And unbeknownst to me, when I did this, they called in this young captain who ran the CSTs. She told me the story later. A senior NCO who was also a Force Recon Marine, and at that point in the military's history, would not have ever worked closely with women, because of combat exclusion rules, he read her the riot act about sending the CSTs outside the wire. And he said if one of them got killed, the enemy would use it for propaganda and hurt the American people's support for the war. So after I heard this story, I looked it up. By this point, we'd already lost 100 female service members in Iraq and Afghanistan. Anyway, she read him the riot act right back, and her version ended what I said. It ended with what I said about being safer with women pulling security. And he didn't have a response to that, so she won. And we went out and did our mission. And I actually went on missions with CSP personnel several more times, always successful.
Wow. I have to wonder, I mean, I know that, you know, women served and obviously in all these different wars, but I wonder how much of a historically accurate character Margaret Houlihan might have been in the 1950s. You know, I mean, obviously the show was dealing with women's lib because that was in American society and in the news in the 70s. And Margaret is a take on that. But it would be interesting to know, like, were there women like this? Were there women that were sort of career women this far back during the Korean War? I don't know the answer to that.
I obviously wasn't there, and I only know from my limited understanding of history, but my understanding was yes. I mean, Admiral Grace Hopper in the Navy was one of the people who helped invent computers. And she went all the way up from, you know, from ensign to admiral and stayed in the career the whole time. And it was that time frame. So yeah, there were women doing this, and they were fighting more than one battle, you know, because they were faced with themselves at the same time they were supporting the country and fighting the enemy.
Marvelous. Yeah, it's just fantastic. Thank you for telling that. That's an amazing, amazing story. I mean, I just think Deluge is just, it's to me, it's of a piece with The More I See You, but in just a completely different way. And the way More I See You is about, you know, the romances and the heartbreak of being in the service and being away from the people you love and what can happen there. This is the guts, the blood and guts of serving. And as I said, the show doesn't hold your hand. It's got these hard edits, very impressionistic kind of edits in some way. And I just think it's a brilliant episode. I never tire of watching it. It flies by, you know, it feels like it's like 8 minutes long. I just think it's an absolutely brilliant episode, and all credit to the film editors, the standard MASH editors, Stanford Titchler and Fred W. Berger, who were the editors on the show, because they really put together the rhythm of this thing is just great. And I love that they managed to have the kind of story beats throughout, or you've got the thing with Potter and Margaret. I mean, it's two scenes, but it's sort of spread out. And then you've got the ongoing beats about how the supplies are running out. It's got all these different storylines, bit by bit by bit, intertwined with all of this footage that they found. And, you know, of course, nowadays it's easy to find all that stuff. It's all on YouTube and just download it and cut it. But back then, you know, these guys had to like dig through cans of film, probably in the 20th Century Fox, B-roll vault, and find all this material and find the kind of stuff they need. So it's an amazing, amazing production. And again, I just think it's an absolutely brilliant episode.
Yeah. It was kind of accidentally groundbreaking.
Yeah.
And I think that it was their decision on what to do to fill the time was inspired.
Yeah. It's really, really marvelous. And he's like, to me, this is just MASH burning on all thrusters. So, okay. So Captain, do you have a particularly favorite line or joke from this episode?
Well, I'm going to ask your indulgence again, because I have a favorite line, but I have a couple runner-ups, but they're fast.
All right, go right ahead.
All right, so the first runner-up is when Radar was negotiating with Dusty and trying to read through his broken glasses, he offered Dusty Jeep butter.
Right, yeah, Jeep butter, yeah.
Yeah, the reason that was so funny to me is because I immediately thought that must be the condiment that Clear uses when he eats Jeeps.
Makes him go down easier.
Yeah, but the first runner up, the next runner up was when Hawkeye told Colonel Potter he'd had a better offer, and Colonel Potter said, "Take me with you." the reason that one's personally important to me is because that kind of happened to me when I got word that I had a Pentagon assignment, when I got word that I was leaving, I passed one of my old bosses in the hall who was having a conversation about the budget that he really didn't want to be in. And he asked me if I'd gotten my orders. And I said, yeah, I'm going to Florida. And he said, take me with you. And then but my actual favorite line was spoken by Father Mulcahy. And it's when Hawkeye tells Father Mulcahy, you know, Father, standing there with the light hitting you the way it does, you look just like a B-girl I knew in San Diego. And Mulcahy says, it's quite possible. I worked my way through divinity school as a B-girl.
That is, I love that Mulcahy just goes with it. It's great. It is really a great moment.
It's super well delivered, and it's just he does it like it just comes to him in the moment.
Yeah, I also love the three of them sitting there just having a sandwich together. Like, it's cute, like them just hanging out together. It's really, really charming. My favorite line is actually in the scene with Klinger. Klinger's monologue, talking about his hometown in Toledo, and he talks about a kid that he knew back in Toledo, Archie Jagloff. And he says he fell down a sewer as a kid and was a Nazi ever since. And he says he got turned down by the army because of flat feet. And Klinger's like, you know how he got flat feet? Goose stepping in his basement. It's just that's that's absolutely marvelous. I also love that Klinger makes the supposition that, of course, the reason he's a Nazi is because the kid banged his head when he was younger, clearly he's got brain damage. That's why he's a Nazi, because he has brain damage. So I think just that whole run by Klinger is great, but I just goose stepping in his basement just makes me laugh so hard. This is so fun.
Yeah, well, brain damage is the best possible excuse, right? I mean, there's
pretty much.
Really, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. All you people out there with the get off Twitter. But anyway, this is just a fantastic episode. To me, it's an A+ episode. It's a show, like I talked about with The More I See You, it's not a show that you see in like greatest hits compilations of MASH. You know, you tend to see the most famous episodes, the ones everyone knows. But this one doesn't get put in those rotations, obviously, because they're going to hit the highlights. But to me, this is really one of the best shows they've ever done. And the fact that it comes when it does in this succession of three, just to me, is why I love the show the way I do. So that's really going to do it for Deluge. Like I said, we're the next to last episode of the season. So Captain Entropy, I mean, thank you so much for coming on and doing this. I mean, again, you've been a commenter on across all of our shows for many years now, and I always enjoy your input. And so thank you so much for volunteering to come on and talk MASH with me.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for letting me in. And thank you especially for letting me be a part of this show. Like you said, it's great.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And you're very welcome. So that's going to do it for this episode of MASHcast. Of course, you can follow the show over on Twitter at MASH477cast. All the back episodes of our show are on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on the podcatcher of your choice. And then, of course, if you want to support the Find Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Stan Peel, Britt Schramm, Mike Thomas, and Michael Porter for their support of MASHcast. I very much appreciate it. So that's going to do it. We'll be back next week. But until then, that is all.
You know, Father, standing there like that with the light hitting you the way it does?
Yes.
You look just like a B-girl I knew in San Diego.
It's quite possible. I worked my way through divinity school as a B-girl in San Diego.